Good afternoon. The Senate Judiciary and Public Safety Committee will come to order. Today's date is February 15th, 2011. We're still waiting for a quorum, but we are going to begin our committee. And I'll be passing the gavel to Senator Newman. I have a bill, Senate File 195, regarding vulnerable adult abuse crime registration. Looking for my reading glasses. What number are we now? Seven? Let the record show that we do have a quorum at this time. And later today, we'll be hearing from Senator Thompson on a uniform commercial code revision, one of my favorite areas of law.
I'm sorry.
Don't worry. Don't get mad. Get even. That's what they say. I think I'll head to the witness stand, and Senator Newman, you've got the wheel.
Thank you, Senator Limmer. We'll wait until you get to the table. Senator Limmer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senate File 195 relates to vulnerable adults in the state of Minnesota, especially in light of the time when they occasionally may suffer from abuse, neglect, or financial exploitation of people who are especially and make them especially susceptible to harm. Some of that harm is created by people that they should be trusting, those that are professional, that have been put, these individuals have been put in care, or even family members that occasionally interact with them. The Vulnerable Adult Act spells out Minnesota's system for dealing with that type of abuse. This bill includes provisions about reporting suspected harm and how public agencies respond. There are also provisions in the criminal code to cover the most serious cases of intentional maltreatment. Senate File 195 strengthens two sections of the criminal code and several provisions in the basic Vulnerable Adult Act. The Vulnerable Adult Act is well in line with Minnesota's public policy to enable people to remain as independent as possible for as long as possible. That means having protections in place, because physical and financial independence for vulnerable adults means being safe from abuse, neglect, or exploitation. Senate File 195 is a product of a group effort. In some of your material that you may have, I don't know if you have this or not, this flyer that might be in your folder.
Senator Limmer, could you identify it? Just read the
title. This one is entitled on the top, Vulnerable Adult Justice Project.
We do have it, Senator Limmer. Thank you.
You have that. In this, you will have a list of agencies, associations, and organizations that have endorsed this legislation that you can review. But like I said, this is a product of a group effort. Since 2007, the Vulnerable Adult Justice Project has brought together representatives from health, social services, law enforcement, and advocacy organizations, public agencies, and private organizations who are working across boundaries to prevent and respond to victimization of vulnerable adults. Today, I'm joined by a number of experts, much more expert than I am on vulnerable adults. But I would like to introduce Ms. Iris Freeman, and she will go through the bill for our behalf, for our.
Ms. Freeman, welcome to the committee. Please proceed.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman and members. My name is Iris Freeman. I'm Associate Director of the Center for Elder Justice and Policy at William Mitchell College of Law. My professional training is in social work, and I've worked in vulnerable adult services and policy for the past 35 years. My part this afternoon is to describe the Vulnerable Adult Justice Project and to summarize the content of Senate File 195. Before I start, one of the questions that is sure to occur in any discussion on this issue is, what is a vulnerable adult? Now, you know, many states have policies and laws that protect the elderly, people a certain age and over. Others have laws that affect the elderly and dependent persons. Minnesota's is Minnesota's own. And the definition of vulnerable adult in Minnesota is this. They're the people who receive certain services, such as nursing home residents do, or folks in licensed group homes, or whether or not they get some kind of a formal service, they have significant impairments, and on top of that, are unable to protect themselves. So that is the population in focus today. The Vulnerable Adult Justice Project is a collaboration of associations, agencies, and viewpoints, all in the cause of safeguarding and advocating for vulnerable adults. We began meeting, as Senator Limmer said, in 2007, and in 2009 produced a bill that tackled the growing problem of financial exploitation, a problem that still grows. It addressed community notification when vulnerable adults go missing and established the model for a streamlined reporting and response system. As Senator Limmer also said, you look at, if you see the roster on this topical summary of the bill, you'll see the composition of the Justice Project. You'll see public advocacy organizations like ombudsman programs, elder and disability organizations like AARP and the Alzheimer's Association, healthcare providers like Care Providers and Aging Services, city prosecutors, county adult protection and prosecutors, the Office of Attorney General, Department of Health, Human Services, the private bar, and law schools. The Vulnerable Adult Justice Project is administratively housed at the Center for Elder Justice. Students at the center have an opportunity to do supervised legal research, and I serve as the coordinator. One big challenge that we have in the field is that vulnerable adult abuse lags behind child protection and domestic violence fields in data, in resources, and best practices. When I began work in the field in the 70s, there wasn't even an adult abuse reporting law in Minnesota. No one was even required to report to public authorities if harm was suspected. That didn't come till 1980. But equally clear is that effective work on these issues and these cases can really be complicated by the fact of our different systems, social services, legal services, law enforcement, different systems, different terminology, different acronyms, which is why our monthly habit of getting together and getting beyond our singular approaches is a good thing for practice. So the shared purpose of the Vulnerable Adult Justice Project is to maintain a regular forum where frontline, supervisory, and policy specialists in vulnerable adult protection can meet to talk about gaps and solutions. Senate File 195 is a product of working across agency boundaries to prevent and respond to the victimization of vulnerable adults. Let me now briefly summarize the bill, and my reference, I hope, is to Ms. Pontius' summary of the bill as it will be amended by the author. There are two changes to the criminal code. One will standardize the penalty for assault of a vulnerable adult at gross misdemeanor. Current law is a gross misdemeanor for defined caregivers, while other assailants who know or have reason to know the vulnerability of the victim today face a lesser penalty. This is in Section 8 and 9 of the bill. The bill would also make the crime of sexual contact with or penetration of a facility resident, patient, or client by a caregiver or service provider employed by the facility, a registrable offense under the predatory offender registration law to conform with the treatment of comparable offenses. And that's in Section 2 of the bill. These two sections are those to which Ms. Godin and Sergeant Wortman will be testifying in a little bit. But the criminal code isn't the whole story when it comes to safeguards. Minnesota law grants a range of appeals to people who are found to have harmed a vulnerable adult. The only review available to a vulnerable adult who is dissatisfied with an agency finding is the Vulnerable Adult Maltreatment Review Panel, one that has existed in law for about 11 years. Three changes in the bill are intended to balance the scale. One is to strengthen the panel's operation to assure a thorough case examination when a vulnerable adult subject of a case feels that, you know, the investigators didn't see the whole picture, that there needs to be another look because the alleged acts weren't substantiated. That clarification is in Section 4. The bill would also allow a vulnerable adult or his or her representative to receive a detailed explanation from the investigative agency when the panel's review makes no recommendation for change, and that's in Section 3. The third would be to notify the vulnerable adult who is the subject of a substantiated case that, and certain legal representatives on that person's behalf, when a substantiated perpetrator appeals the finding, and we intend to establish a means for the vulnerable adult in the situation or the vulnerable adult's advocates to submit information or to have a voice that will be considered in that appeal hearing. The remaining portions are largely technical. One is to clarify the jurisdictions of licensing agencies and counties for investigating maltreatment by using plainer contemporary terms. That's in Section 16. There are a number of sections in which the current term lead agency is modified to lead investigative agency because at the time that this law was enacted, this was the only lead agency. And today in law, there are any number of others known by that. And so this modification to lead investigative agency is included in sections 1, 4, 6, 7, 10, 11, 13, 14, 16, and the revisor's instruction 17. Next to last, this bill would ensure that guardians and healthcare agents receive information about maltreatment of a vulnerable adult pursuant to the duties given them by the vulnerable adult or the court. That is in Section 12. And finally, this bill would add the category representatives from local tribal governments to those that a county may invite to participate in a multidisciplinary adult protection team to improve response to vulnerable adults who live on reservations. This is permissive in both ways. Counties currently under law have the right to pull together different entities, organizations, agencies to work together on vulnerable adult cases. There are also a number of entities they may invite, such as a mental health organization. And this would add to that list of you may if you want to, and they may accept if they want to, representatives of tribal government in areas of the state where that would make sense. And that, Mr. Chairman and members, is my testimony. And I don't know whether Senator Limmer would like to have the other two witnesses testify before we go further.
Thank you, Ms. Freeman. Senator Limmer.
Mr. Chair, I think what we should do first is have the proponents, the testifiers give proponent testimony first, and then we'll delve into the A2 amendment when they're done.
That's fine, Senator Limmer. I would indicate that I did receive a note. There are two members from the public want to address the a question regarding the amendment, which we will take up at the appropriate time.
Mr. Chair, it's the A3 amendment, not A2.
Yes, I have it in front of me. Your next testifier, Senator Lemmer.
Ms. Godin.
Sure.
Please welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Lisa Godin, and I am a supervising attorney at the Minneapolis City Attorney's Office. I've been in the office for almost 11 years, and for about 8 of the years that I've been at the City Attorney's Office as a prosecutor, I've been the only prosecutor that works on vulnerable adult crimes. And so it's that interest that I have that brought me to the subcommittee of the Vulnerable Adult Justice Project that deals with the criminal code. And I'm here today to address the two provisions in the bill, SF 195, that pertain to the criminal prosecution area. The proposal contained in SF 195, which is supported by our subcommittee and by the City of Minneapolis, would improve enforcement of the laws that protect vulnerable adults from crimes in two specific ways, as Iris and Senator Limmer have outlined. Those two ways are, first, to standardize the penalty for assault
Ms. Godin, excuse me, could you speak up and maybe pull the mic
sure.
just a little closer to yourself?
I can try, thanks. The two specific proposals that are contained in this bill are, first, to standardize the penalty for assault of a vulnerable adult at a gross misdemeanor level offense, and second, to make the criminal sexual abuse of a facility resident, patient, or client by a caregiver or service provider a registrable offense under the predatory offender registration law to conform with the treatment of comparable offenses. The first part of these proposals is the gross misdemeanor assault on a vulnerable adult. That's contained in sections 8 and 9. The issue at hand is that the knowing assault on a vulnerable adult committed by someone who is not a caregiver is currently a misdemeanor level offense. And what this proposal would do is to make that a gross misdemeanor level offense by making that crime assault in the fourth degree. This change is reflected, as I said, in sections 8 and 9 of the legislation. Currently, in most cases where a person, not a caregiver, assaults a vulnerable adult whom they know to be vulnerable, that is a misdemeanor. But if the perpetrator is a caregiver and is in a caregiving relationship with a vulnerable adult, that is a gross misdemeanor level offense. That is contained in existing law, which is Minnesota Statute 609.224, subdivision 2C. What this proposal would do is recognize the special vulnerability of many elderly and disabled people. The intent of the proposal is to make assaults committed by individuals who know of a victim's vulnerability the same level of offense as similar assaults that are now committed by caregivers. The proposed amendment adds a subdivision to 609.2231, the fourth degree assault section. This section covers fourth-degree assaults and makes these assaults gross misdemeanors when they're perpetrated on certain categories of persons. Those are categories like peace officers, secure treatment facility personnel, and community crime prevention group members. Notably, bias-motivated assaults are included in this subdivision. This type of assault that we're targeting in this proposal is similar to that, in that bias-motivated assaults are targeting someone for a particular vulnerability, and that's exactly what we're targeting here. When someone knowingly assaults a vulnerable adult and causes demonstrable bodily harm, we believe that that's a special type of offense and that that should be punishable accordingly. The second section that pertains to criminal law is the predatory offender registry, and that's contained in Section 2. SF 195 adds criminal sexual abuse of a vulnerable adult that is committed by a caregiver to the list of crimes for which defendants charged and convicted of specific crimes must register as predatory offenders. Specifically, the crime being added is contained in 609.2325, subdivision 1B, which prohibits criminal abuse of a vulnerable adult when a caregiver engages in sexual contact, or sexual penetration of a vulnerable adult. This is narrowly tailored language. The criminal abuse law exempts personal care attendants from this crime altogether, so PCAs cannot be charged with this offense. And it also exempts situations in which there was a pre-existing consensual sexual relationship before the caregiver relationship began. We would note that the predatory offender registration laws were initially enacted in 1991, largely in response to concerns about the Jacob Wetterling case. In 1994, the law was substantially broadened to include a number of offenses that were not originally included in the 1991 enactment. However, in 1995, 1 year after that substantial broadening, the vulnerable adult law was substantially revised. And it's our belief on the subcommittee that there was sort of an oversight in both camps that this type of crime was not included in the original enactment. So this is sort of a corrective fix to that. The VHAP proposal aims to address what appears to be, as I said, an oversight in existing law. The reason that criminal sexual abuse of a vulnerable adult should be included as a registrable offense is that the nature of this offense is equally egregious as the types of conduct for which registration is already required, especially criminal sexual conduct. Current law requires registration for crim sex 1 through 4, criminal sexual conduct in the fifth degree, which is sexual contact and touching with prior convictions, and criminal sexual predatory conduct. And although criminal sexual abuse of a vulnerable adult is rarely charged, I can tell you in my time prosecuting these cases, I've charged two of these cases. Adding this offense to the list of registrable offenses will ensure justice for vulnerable victims of these crimes. And so we ask your support for these two changes. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Godin. Sergeant Wartman, if you want to pull the microphone close to you so you can speak right into it, I want to welcome you to the committee. Please identify yourself and proceed.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman and committee members. My name is Mike Wartman. I'm a sergeant with the St. Paul Police Department. At present, I'm assigned to the newly established Crimes Against the Elderly Unit. I am also a certified instructor through the Department of Justice to teach law enforcement officers the dynamics of investigating crimes against elderly and vulnerable adults. Several years ago, our then Chief of Police and now Senator Harrington had the vision to know the importance, to see the importance of developing a specified unit within our department that sole responsibility would be to investigate crimes against the elderly and vulnerable adults. The Crimes Against Elderly Unit was formally established in September of last year. Since then, I've been assigned strictly to investigate those types of crimes. Those crimes, as we can probably all understand, are growing and growing and growing. As the age of our population matures, the more of these crimes are going to be out there. I'm here today to talk a little bit about the amendments that we're put before you, number one being the assault of a vulnerable adult by somebody other than a caregiver to the gross misdemeanor level. I've investigated numerous crimes against vulnerable adults involving assault. One specifically was an example would be a neighbor had been living next to a vulnerable adult for a number of years, fully knowing that this person was a vulnerable adult. Knowing that this person didn't have cognitive ability to really make rational decisions, was out shoveling her sidewalk and accidentally threw some snow onto his driveway. With that, he went out and assaulted her, knowing her vulnerability. All we could get was a misdemeanor on that case. That's an example of what we're looking for to enhance this to a gross misdemeanor. The second part of that is the sexual predator amendment, which would make it a register offense by a staff member of a facility convicted of criminal abuse of a vulnerable adult, including criminal sexual contact and penetration, to be mandated to be a predatory offender. Sorry, a little nervous. Several cases that I've worked at before are members of the staff of the facility taking a vulnerable adult out of the facility against regulations, against their policies, taking this individual to their home, administering drugs and alcohol to the victim, and then taking sexual advantage of him. The reason the vulnerable adult reminded her of her ex-boyfriend. Several new cases I've had within the last week involve primary care attendants at facilities sexually groping, I should say, is a good word, the elderly residents of that facility as they're being assisted into the bathroom or getting the bath or shower. Right now, as it stands, these staff members are not required to register as predatory offenders, and this will help us in our investigations to keep track of them. In closing, I'd just like to add that in my experience, I've been doing this since 2007, and these numbers are growing and growing and growing. Our department is averaging 60 to 65 cases of vulnerable adult or elderly abuse every month. I was in Beltrami County all last week teaching a class to law enforcement. When I got back yesterday, I had 17 new cases on my desk. So these are out there. They're becoming more prominent, and we need the help to keep track of these. Thank you.
Thank you, Sergeant Wortman. Senator Limmer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. At this time, I'd like to introduce the A3 amendment.
Okay, Senator Limmer moves the A3 amendment. Are there any questions or is there any discussion?
Well, Mr. Chairman, I might want to describe the A3 amendment.
And okay, go right ahead.
That might trigger a few questions. This is basically in response to some of the concerns by Department of Human Services. The original bill created some administrative responsibilities on them, which also not only in and of themselves also could contribute to extra costs. And as we reviewed some of their recommendations in order to alter the bill slightly, as I was looking at it, I added a few changes to their changes. So I'd like to describe the amendment before us. As we go down, as we begin page 4, this is the first line 2 of the amendment. This removes section 15 of the bill regarding hearing office responsibility.
Excuse me, Senator Limmer, could you pull the mic closer to you? It's not picking you up very well. Thank you.
The reference to line 2 removes section 15 of the bill. That involves hearing officers and the procedures involved. We'll be replacing that with language found below. Nevertheless, there was a question of whether or not the victim should participate in the hearing as the department reviews what had happened and what conviction had ultimately come about, and how they administratively can handle this individual as well as perhaps the facility under their jurisdiction. There was a concern with DHS that the victim need not be present as they reviewed privately the circumstances that led to the abuse, as well as what, from an administrative standpoint, their reaction should be. I had a slight difference with that. I thought that in any case, you should have the victim follow the procedure, at least be allowed to sit in on the meetings. After all, this is an individual that in most cases have been found guilty at that point of a criminal abuse, and that the victim, if they wanted to, at their expense, they could attend that hearing. They would not have a right to be heard at that because the evidence and other circumstances would be known to the panel, but the panel could ask questions of the victim if they chose. Also, the question of notice of when the individual victim would be notified of that hearing, how would that come about? The original language just said that notice would occur. And being around this body long enough, sometimes you need to be a little bit more specific, especially when you're dealing with a victim. Is notice leaving a message on a telephone answering machine, is that adequate, or should it be something in written form? I defaulted to, as far as I could, a certified mail notice in order to notify the victim that there's going to be hearings regarding the specific nature of the abuse, as well as what type of administrative procedure may be a result of that finding. The new language that's before you, I wanted to itemize that first because the Department of Human Services, I just got done talking with, they had a few concerns about my alterations, but nevertheless, I think we're continuing to understand where we're going. This committee still, if passed here, it would go to the Department of, or not Department, the Committee on Health and Human Services. So this is not the last stop. But as you, if I can go back to the amendment before you, starting on line 9, page 5, line 22, recommendation must include an explanation of factors that form the basis of recommendation to reconsider final disposition, and must specifically identify disputed facts. This is a review administratively of the circumstances that led to the abuse, especially in a healthcare facility. The minor reference on page 5, line 25, that's line 14 of the amendment, deletes the word investigative and simply changes it to factors identified by the panel. Going down to line 16, this is specific language that DHS had recommended in order to not only address the situation, do it in a cost-effective manner, but also to make it as easy as on their department as possible in order to address the concerns that were raised by the abuse itself. If you look on line 23, 24, and 25, I made reference to certified mail being the method of notice. On line 24 and going through 25, that victims would be able to attend the proceedings at their own expense. And throughout the paragraph, it makes reference to how the procedure would occur, time limits involved, and that this particular subdivision does not limit, prevent, or excuse the adult from being called as a witness to testify at the hearing, or at least grant the vulnerable adult or guardian a right to participate in proceedings. Going on to the second page, line 4, where it says the lead investigative agency must notify the healthcare agent of the vulnerable adult only if healthcare agent's authority to make healthcare decisions are not, and the investigation relates to a duty assigned. This is when to notify the healthcare agent during the investigation. It gives a little reference to that. There may be at times contested case hearings. Again, another hearing, an administrative hearing, where again, similar to the first page, it makes references when an appeal of an investigative agency results in a contested case. Again, it's important to make sure that the vulnerable adult is available for the hearing, to be invited to the hearing through a certified mail, and of course to attend at their own expense. It also makes reference to administrative law judges, that they too can be involved in officiating at the hearing. I think that's about it. Any questions?
If I might, Ms. Chair and Senator Limmer.
Ms. Gooden.
It's my teaching experience. I was noticing some furrowed brows. If I could just clarify where in the Vulnerable Adult Act these provisions occur, because they have some different subjects to them.
Please proceed, Ms. Freeman.
From lines 2.4 to 2.8, you have language that refers to the Vulnerable Adult Maltreatment Review Panel. That's an administrative panel that the vulnerable adult may may seek, and that is different from these other two appeals issues. The Vulnerable Adult Maltreatment Review Panel is a paper-only review, and this language simply strengthens what the original bill had. From lines 2.10 to I started on the wrong page. I had the right thing, and I mean, I had the right intent, but I had the wrong delivery. May I start again on page one of the amendment?
To the amendment, Ms. Freeman.
Section 3, that is a section that will turn up later as 15. Page 5, lines 1.3 to 6, has to do with the maltreatment review panel, and adding a county representative to that maltreatment review panel. Right now, only two of the three lead agencies serve on it, Department of Health, Department of Human Services. The counties are also a lead agency for investigation. This adds them to the bunch. Lines 1.8 to 15 further beef up that maltreatment review panel operations. And then starting on 1.16 and over to 2.2, that is the first area where the department had offered language that would help us hear the voice of the vulnerable adult in those appeals hearings that are brought on behalf of a substantiated perpetrator. Senator Limmer's additions go to how the mail should be sent and whether or not the vulnerable adult herself or himself can be there. That language is just the same as the language in 2.10 to 2.33, because although most of the hearings are held by the Department of Human Services appeals officers, some are heard by the administrative law judge. Now, on page 2, where I didn't belong the first time, that 2.3 change is grammar. 2.4 has to do not with any of the appeals panels or reviews, but with the situation where a lead agency is investigating a vulnerable adult case. And this describes when, in the course of investigating a vulnerable adult case, should the guardian or the health care agent of that individual be notified that this vulnerable adult investigation is going on. It narrows this. I mean, it both broadens and specifies those situations. As I said, lines 210 to 233 are the contested hearings having to do with an appeal by a substantiated perpetrator. And then lines 2.34 and 2.35 eliminate a sentence in the bill that the department felt would add a fiscal note, and it has been our intent that this be a policy bill. And so I thank you, Senator Limmer, and members for allowing that those additional footnotes.
Thank you, Ms. Freeman. Any questions from the committee? Senator Letts.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. To whomever can answer the question, on the A3 amendment, line 1.2, the deletion of section 3, you say that shows up later as section 15 in the amendment, or at line 2.10 of the amendment, a new section 15 for the bill, but they seem to address different statutory sections. Section 3 of the bill applies to statute 245C.28, and the new section 15 applies only to 626.557. So can you explain how it shows up later in the bill but is to a different statute and why?
Ms. Freeman.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Lett, I think it is the Department of Human Services representative, one of whom who is here, that drafted this section 15, but the greater part of section 15, who can best describe why the statutory reference changes.
Is there somebody from the department? Thank you for coming up to the table. Please pull the mic towards you. Identify yourself.
Mr. Chair and members, my name is Jerry Kerber, and I'm the Director of the Licensing Division of the Department of Human Services. And Mr. Chair and Senator Latz, that's a good observation on your part. I think what we're trying to do here is to make sure that all of the contested case hearings get represented in this change. And so just in summary, when we substantiate maltreatment, substantiated perpetrators have appeal rights. And in every case, they have a hearing. The default hearing is a fair hearing, as mentioned, and that gets addressed in the first section on page one. However, in some cases, because of the unique characteristics of either the individual or the situation, there's a contested case hearing right. And so a number of years ago, there were a number of statutory changes made that consolidated appeals. And so basically we rounded up. And so if we're taking a licensing sanction as a result of a maltreatment finding, then the appeal process is a contested case hearing. And so in that contested case hearing, the maltreatment issue comes along with it. And so the provision that was in the original bill under 245C is just the background study law. Chapter 245C is a human services background study law. And the contested case hearing right in that law, as it related to maltreatment, only kicked in when it was a public employee who was substantiated as a perpetrator of maltreatment and who was appealing it. Public employees have a contested case hearing right for disqualification purposes, and everybody else has a fair hearing right. And so in order to broaden the changes that Senator Limmer is making here to those hearings, it made more sense to move it over into the Vulnerable Adult Act and try and catch them all. If for whatever reason the person is in a contested case hearing and there's a review of that maltreatment finding as a part of the contested case hearing, then these provisions kick in.
Senator Latz.
Another question kind of had to do with the question of the fiscal note. We've got two fiscal bits of information in our packet, one the request worksheet and the one the preliminary fiscal note. The request worksheet seems to have some fiscal implications. Let's say that there are some for the DHS licensing division. And the preliminary fiscal note seems to have no fiscal implication. So maybe, I don't know how that applies to the amendment specifically, but since you mentioned that one section was deleted to avoid fiscal impact, maybe you can explain.
Senator Latz.
Senator Limmer.
I'm going to turn it over to Mr. Turner to give you a definition.
Mr. Curtis.
Mr. Chairman, members, there are two. There's a preliminary fiscal note in your packet. It was filled out by every department except for the Department of Human Services. They all stated that that this bill did not impact their agency. The second one is a fiscal note request worksheet that was on the way to the Department of Finance, or MMB. They weren't able to sign off the final fiscal note, which is why it's preliminary. Human Services found that this bill did have an impact to the state of $61,000 in fiscal year 12 and $54,000 in fiscal year 13. And that's because Section 16 of the bill required them to hire another investigator. So it was the intent of Senator Limmer to have this a pure policy bill. He worked with the Department of Human Services and Mr. Jerry Kerber, who's at the table. Mr. Kerber said that in order to make the bill fiscally neutral, what we had to do was on page 2 of the amendment, the A3, lines 2.34 and 2.35, we had to delete that single sentence in Section 16. And so that is included in the A3, and if the A3 passes or when it passes, the bill will be fiscally neutral.
Thank you, Mr. Turner. Any other questions? Senator Limmer.
Mr. Chair.
I'm sorry. Senator Ingebretson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And to whoever could answer on the amendment, line 1.7, It states the Commissioner of Human Services or the Administrator's designee. Is that a Department of Human Services employee, or could that be a guardian ad litem?
Would you like me to?
Ms. Freeman?
Mr. Chair and Senator Ingebrigtsen, this section is one that refers to the Vulnerable Adult Maltreatment Review Panel, which is made up currently of a representative of the Department of Health, one of the Department of Human Services, both of those being lead agencies, someone from the Board on Aging, and someone from the Ombudsman Office for Long-Term Care, and someone from the Ombudsman Office for Mental Health and Developmental Disabilities. This addition is to bring in the third of the lead investigative agencies. So it would be a public a representative rather than an individual's guardian, and it could either be a representative of County Human Services Administration or that person's designee, but the decision as to which county got the call would be the Commissioner of Human Services.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Any further discussion? Senator Limmer, I believe this is an author's amendment. Do you wish to move the A3 amendment at this time?
I would wish to move the A3 amendment.
Any further discussion to the A3 amendment to Senate File 195? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
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 All those opposed, no. The motion passes. The amendment is adopted to Senate File 195 as amended. Senator Marty.
Mr. Chair, just a brief question, maybe for Ms. Freeman. Under the fourth degree assault in Section 8, we talk about demonstrable bodily harm, and I was just curious. It seems to me that a lot of vulnerable adults who are physically vulnerable, not mentally vulnerable, might be terrorized in such a way. Do we ever have them, and is that covered? Because I can't picture a lot of that being demonstrable. Is that taken care of through other terroristic threats type of thing? Or
Mr. Ms. Chairman Freeman. And Senator Marty, this is a question for a prosecutor.
Ms. Godin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Senator Marty, your question is about I'm not sure it's specific.
Ms. Godin, please pull the mic a little closer. So
Mr. Chairman, if demonstrable bodily harm, it presumably does not cover something that's purely mentally terrorize the person. If there's no demonstrable, I assume that's the case, you could not charge somebody with demonstrable if you couldn't see it, even if it was, you could demonstrate that the person was hurt, you would not charge under this then. Is there something else covered, or is that not a situation that arises?
Ms. Gordon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Senator Marty, thank you for the clarification. I think that the best way to answer that is it's very fact-specific what type of crime would be charged. Terroristic threats is a felony that could be charged depending on what sort of threat was made to the person. There's also assault fear that sometimes in sort of lower-level cases where there is a threat of bodily harm, assault fear, which would be a fifth-degree assault misdemeanor, we could charge that. There's a number of other criminal statutes that could apply depending on the conduct.
Any further questions? Any other discussion? Seeing none, Senator Limmer, do you now wish to move your bill at this point?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. I would like to move Senate File 195 as amended, be recommended to pass, and be referred to the Health and Human Service Committee.
Senator Limmer moves Senate File 195 as amended, mm-hmm. be recommended to pass, and re-referred to the Health and Human Services Committee. Any further discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, no. The motion is passed, and the bill is adopted and re-referred.
Thank you, Mr.
Thank you.
Chairman and members.
Thank you.
And thank you, Senator.
What's that? You never know.
We will at this time take up Senate File 194.
There is some.
state of Minnesota. Let's just go.
Is it on everybody?
Nice work.
Senator Thompson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members, I come here today to propose Senate File 194, and this bill is a clarification or a restructuring of some of the Uniform Commercial Code, which deals with secured transactions of personal property. And the best way to think of that is when you go buy a home, your mortgage company gives you a loan, takes a lien on your home. And that, of course, is a mortgage on real property. This particular section of the Uniform Commercial Code deals with that type of an arrangement, except instead of being real estate, it is a lien on personal property. And it allows creditors to get liens on anything that is not real estate, that is personal property, that they want to attach in order to go ahead and give a loan. My understanding is that this is a change in the law that is desired by the practicing bar in this area, that there really is, I'm unaware of any opposition to it, but rather this is something that will make the wheels move more smoothly in transactions and therefore hopefully make things go more quickly, cut down on litigation. And since I am not expert in this area of law, I'm glad that I've got somebody here today that can help us out. And so I would like to welcome Mr. Gene Hennig to the committee, Mr. Chairman, who will explain this. And I'm sure be happy to take any questions from the members, and I'll be happy to take questions. Just I won't be able to answer any of them. So, Mr. Hennig, thank you.
Mr. Hennig, welcome to the committee. Please state your name and proceed.
Thank you very much. Senator Thompson, members of the committee, my name once again is Gene Hennig. I am one of Minnesota's Uniform Law Commissioners, and it's my pleasure to speak with you today on something that's terribly exciting to me, and I hope by the end of my presentation will be of equal exciting to you. I would also like to introduce, before going further, to my far right, Professor Fred Miller. Professor Fred Miller wrote a good chunk of the Uniform Commercial Code. He is one of the most distinguished uniform law commissioners in America today. And most significantly, he has recently relocated to Minnesota. So we brought him along today in case I screw up or stub my toe. I have truly brought Zeus to the mountaintop, and we should be able to proceed very effectively. As Senator Thompson mentioned to you, what we're talking about this afternoon for a few minutes has to do with the Uniform Commercial Code. I'll take you back just a little bit because probably not all of you go to sleep with it at night as I do. But the Uniform Commercial Code is a very important collection of statutes which govern many aspects of commercial law in the United States. The Uniform Commercial Code has been around now for the last 50 years. Here in Minnesota, we've had it on the books since 1965. It's been adopted in every single state in the country, and it truly is one of the most significant uniform statutes that's ever been written. What we're going to be talking about today more specifically is Article 9 of the Uniform Commercial Code, which deals with the subject of secured transactions. And as Senator Thompson correctly pointed out, this deals specifically with liens against personal property. Now, I realize that just this morning the governor announced his budget, and that's of great importance to all of you. Perhaps this is only of secondary importance to you, but I can assure you that it's still important, very important. Liens against personal property are important for businesses, they're important for farmers, they're important for consumers. There's hardly anybody other than perhaps babies that are not affected by Article 9 of the Uniform Commercial Code, and even they may be affected as well in ways that I'm not aware. But liens against personal property really make the acquisition of both business and personal assets possible. As Senator Thompson pointed out, a very good analogy that to something you are more familiar with is the law of real estate. Most of you have probably bought houses at one time or another. You've probably gotten financing on your houses. And the liens against real estate, of course, are known as mortgages. And if you just think through what you did at the time you were buying a house, you signed a contract that was called a mortgage. And then, of course, that mortgage had to be placed in the public record, and so it was filed. And most of you are aware of the fact that mortgages and deeds and things like that are filed in the public record with the county recorder's office. Well, the law of personal property finance is somewhat similar. Here again, you can take liens against personal assets. These liens have a peculiar name or a particular name. It's called a security interest, but it's much the same as a mortgage. It's stuck to the collateral, which is an item of personal property. It could be a boat. It could be an airplane. It could be inventory, what have you. And then here again, it's necessary that those liens be made a part of the public record. And the way that happens is through the UCC filing system, which is something I'll mention in just a second. But the analog that was mentioned before holds up very nicely here. We're talking about liens and personal property, and it's these liens which really facilitate, as I have said before, the whole personal property finance world. Now, Article 9 of the Uniform Commercial Code has been around, as I said, since the 1960s. Some of you may recall, although you'd be unusual if you did, 10 years ago, a decade ago, some very significant changes were made to Article 9 of the UCC, and those have been adopted universally, and that's fine. The changes we're suggesting this time around are of far less significance, far less consequence. They're important. It's just that they're not as overreaching or as significant as the ones before. One of the nice things about these revisions, I'm happy to tell you, in contrast to the governor's budget, as far as I can tell, it won't cost anything. So this bill is an excellent opportunity for you to make the world a better place without having to spend any money, which doesn't oftentimes happen. The specific revisions to Article 9, most of which are quite technical, and I won't belabor you this afternoon with all of the technical minutiae because it probably is beyond what your level of interest would be at the moment. But the one area that I would like to visit with you for just a couple of minutes about has to do with the whole business of how do you put the world on notice that a lien known as a security interest in personal property exists. If you go back to my mortgage example for just a second, you'll remember that I said, when you take a mortgage in a house or a building, what do you have to do? You have to file it with the county recorder. And why do you do that? It's to put the world on notice, third parties on notice, that somebody has a lien against that real estate. Well, the same is true for personal property finance. If I have a lien against some business's inventory or against somebody's boat, for example, how do I put other people on notice that I have that lien? Well, you do it through something called a UCC financing statement. And we've passed out for you an example of what a UCC financing statement looks like. These things are very exciting to people like Professor Miller and myself. Perhaps not for you, but let me tell you why these things are very significant and very important. First of all, this is the document. It's quite simple when you look at it, that gets filed with the Secretary of State here in our state and just about every other state. So when our Secretary of State, Mark Ritchie, isn't messing with election recounts and other drab things like that, he is worried about managing the UCC filing office. And this is a very significant part of his responsibilities. You'll notice that this UCC financing statement contains some really basic information. It contains in box one the name of the debtor. And this is just a hypothetical example that's actually based on a real debtor that's named this. But in our particular case here, you'll see that the name of the debtor is a fellow by the name of Terry Kindernecht. That's in box 1B, just by way of example. The name of the creditor, just by way of example, is down in box 3. That's John Deere Credit. And the collateral that we're talking about in this particular example is one John Deere combine, right? It's a very simple document. This is the thing which is filed along with $20 in the Secretary of State's office, and now the world has a public record of this lien. All of this is well and good, except there's been a problem, and it's been not an insignificant problem, and that is, believe it or not, how do we get the debtor's name right? You'd think that would be pretty darn simple. But it's terribly important, and I'll tell you why. Because all of this is indexed against the debtor's name. And these days, with electronic filing systems, it gets all the more important. It's just like looking up the debtor's name in the phone book, or nowadays looking up something on the Internet. What happens if you get even a single character wrong in what your search is looking for? You're not going to find what you're looking for. And so this whole business of getting the debtor's name right has taken on very, very great significance. In the particular example that I've given you, if you look, this is a real farmer, actually, in Kansas. It's listed there. This fellow's name is Terry J. Kindernecht, great German name. You would think that if you spelled Kindernecht correctly, that ought to be good enough. Well, you know what? This name wasn't good enough in a particular case not long ago. And the reason it wasn't good enough is because they didn't lay out this poor farmer's full name. And his full name was Terence Joseph Kindernecht. He hadn't been called that, I venture to say, since the day he was baptized. Okay, but for UCC filing purposes, it was necessary that that whole name get put in there correctly. Otherwise, this filing isn't any good. You might say, well, who cares if the filing's not any good? Well, if the filing's not any good, you lose in bankruptcy. John Deere Company lost tens of thousands of dollars because the name was wrong. And so getting the debtor's name right is terribly, terribly important. One of the things, one of the most important things that Senate File 194 is working on is to clear that up. And to say it very simply, the way the law is going to be if this law is adopted is we'll start looking to a debtor's name as it appears on his or her driver's license. That's something folks, almost everybody has, and they carry it around in their pocket. We can look at what their name is on their driver's license. If it's Terry J. Kindernecht on the driver's license, okay. But if it's Terrence, then you got to get the whole name like that down on the driver's license. Now, this all may strike you as not being terribly important or necessary, but I can assure you that this kind of stuff here will be of great benefit to both businesses and consumers alike in this state and throughout the United States, because this is scheduled for uniform adoption here in this state and throughout. Let me just summarize by saying this is, as I said, a uniform act. There are many more technicalities we could talk about, and I'll be happy to respond to those things. But what we are interested in seeing happen this year is for this particular set of revisions to be adopted. They will have a uniform effective date of July 1, 2013. It's out a couple years so that all 50 states can go on the same effective date. And this is very important because of the way in which consumer finance works in this country. The final thing I'll say is I think it was mentioned before, I don't think there's any particular controversy about this. It's a uniform statute. It's certainly been carefully thought out. It's been reviewed carefully by the UCC committee of the State Bar Association here in Minnesota and has its support. And as I said, I think it would certainly be in the best interest of the citizens of this state and the people we're all trying to serve if this were adopted. I do appreciate your time and would be happy to entertain any questions that anybody would have.
Thank you, Mr. Hennig. Senator Thompson.
Mr. Chairman, I understand the members may have questions, but I did not formally move the Senate file, so I would ask that Senate File 194 be referred out of committee to the full Senate for a vote once you have taken the questions that you want to take.
Okay, are there any questions? Senator Ingebrigtsen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and this is very exciting stuff. There's no
yes, thank you.
My question is, those folks that have registered with the J instead of James,
right?
Is this going to trigger all of those that are on file now to have to come back and put their names?
There's a period of time, I believe it's 1 year, when corrections can be made. But, yes, there is a transition period, if you will, when folks will have to – it will be up to the lenders, really, to do this. It's not the debtor's responsibility to make these fixes. So if John Deere, for example, or a lender has some financing statements that are out there that need correction, they'll have a period of time, a year, to get them fixed. And it's not unlike transition periods that we've experienced before when other amendments have been made. But again, it's to bring it into line so that we all know what we're talking about on the debtor's true name. Another thing I'll say, Senator Ingebrigtsen, is that in most cases, the majority of cases, the debtor's true name is going to be the same as what's on their driver's license, so no correction will be necessary. But there are instances, like in the example that I gave you, where there could be some variance.
Thank you, Mr. Henning. Any further questions?
Just to follow up on that. So will there be you said there would be no cost. It would be cost to the debtor then. So there would be no cost to the state of Minnesota.
There would be Mr. no cost to the state of Minnesota. There might be an amendment cost to the lender to fix financing statements that require fixing. But there should be no cost that I'm aware of to the state budget, to the Secretary of State's budget, or whatnot.
Thank you.
Senator Limmer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Judge, or am I under the proper understanding that this particular uniform law has been accepted in all 50 states?
Senator Limmer, it is out for adoption in all the 50 states. What actually happened is the Uniform Commercial Code, it's a uniform act. It's jointly written by members of the American Law Institute and the Uniform Law Commission. It was officially promulgated this past summer. So this is really the first session that any state can undertake to adopt it. And as far as I know, and maybe Professor Miller can comment further, but my understanding is that there are movements afoot in every state. And we're certainly working towards, across the next couple of years, getting it adopted so that it can be uniformly adopted effective in 2013.
Well, Judge, the reason I ask the question is we, Mr. Tennyson comes here often and tries to regale us of the virtue of uniform law. And I keep asking the question, how uniform is uniform law when only a handful of states become uniform, and the rest of the union does not.
Sure.
And it doesn't seem like there's a long crusade in order to get the rest of the states on board. So, do we really get to the uniformity that we really want,
Mr. Henning?
Yes, Senator Limmer. You're quite right. My fellow Commissioner Tennyson is quite the missionary for uniform legislation. And I am not – I hesitate to say that I'm walking in his same shoes. But to answer your question, I would anticipate that every single state will adopt the proposed revisions on target. It's quite true, Senator Limmer, that some uniform acts are adopted and some aren't, and you don't really get in every uniform act case uniformity throughout the country, although that's certainly the goal. In the case of the Uniform Commercial Code, it currently is adopted by every single state in the country. The amendments 10 years ago were adopted by every single state in the country, and I would be astonished if we don't get uniform adoption on this.
Okay. One last question.
Senator,
are you aware whether or not the business community has had a chance to review this? Certainly there might be a cost to merchants or manufacturers that have to go through this correction process. Costs will be someone has to pay the cost on this. I'm assuming that's the business. Has anyone from the business community in the state had any opinion on your bill?
Sure.
Mr. Henning.
Senator Limmer, there are other constituencies that are certainly following this. We do have in the hearing room today representatives from the Minnesota Bankers Association, for example. They have reviewed this. They told me earlier, but they're certainly welcome to come forward and answer it directly, but they have not expressed any opposition to this legislation and indeed support it. But like I said, others certainly besides just lawyers have been looking at this.
Any further questions from the committee? Seeing none, Senator Thompson moves his bill recommending it to pass to the floor of the Senate. Senate File 194. All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, motion passes.
Thank you very much.
Good to meet you, sir. No other business before the committee.
There being no other business before the committee, we stand adjourned.
Good job. So.